during the Obama administration be undone.
The notion that the Cuban people will be allowed freedom of speech and freedom of information now that President Obama has made concessions to the very government denying them these rights is complete fiction.
For more global news headlines, visit talkradionews.com.
McMiniman's, the Portland Mercury, and X-Ray FM present this year's Sabretooth Microfest on February 5th through 7th with Red Fang, Built to Spill, The Super Furry Animals, Michael Cronin, Earth, and more over three nights on the Crystal Ballroom stage. Full lineup and information on related festivities can be found at sabretoothpdx.com.
You're listening to KXRY Portland at 107.1 and 91.1 FM. Streaming online everywhere at xray.fm. Coming up next is Reveal. Thanks for listening to X-Ray FM.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. The number of Border Patrol agents guarding the U.S.-Mexico border has nearly doubled in the last 10 years, and the consequences for the people they catch have gotten more serious.
Order in the corridor, rise.
Each year, more than 70,000 people are prosecuted for immigration crimes.
All the immigrants we're looking around, everybody's locked up from the ankles, knees, waist, and each other.
And they're filling up a new kind of federal prison, set up to save money. But inmates are paying the price, especially when it comes to medical care.
What you're doing is you're putting barriers between that person who may have a medical emergency and the care.
And I know you want to ask me, what would I do to correct the problem? I'd close this whole facility down and I'd start over again.
This week on Reveal, medical negligence in prisons that only house immigrants. But first, this news.
Hi, I'm Lena Newman, and this is Other Cinema This Week, your weekly roundup of movie screenings and events in Portland, Oregon, focused on the experimental, politically radical, and difficult-to-classify moving image arts. Here's what's on view, Friday, February 5th through Thursday, February 11th. The 26th annual Cascade Festival of African Films kicks off this week. The festival highlights a variety of feature and documentary films from the African continent, the majority of which were made by African directors. The festival seeks to celebrate Africa's achievements, expose Africa's failures, and to show Africa through the eyes of Africans, rather than a vision that is packaged primarily for Western viewers. The selections offered in this year's festival cover a wide range of themes and topics, including music and the arts, revolution, displaced children, poverty and the difficulties of urban life, and the struggle for gender equality and freedom. For the opening night screening, the festival welcomes Merzak Alouache, Algeria's foremost film director, to present his feature-length drama, The Rooftops. Taking place over a single day and paced by the five daily calls to prayer, the film tells five independent stories that intermingle and clash, all set on the rooftop terraces of five historic neighborhoods in Algiers. The Rooftops presents a microcosm of Algerian society and casts a critical eye on important social issues such as class and gender inequality, poverty, corruption, and the rise of religious fundamentalism. The Rooftops plays Friday, February 5th at the Hollywood Theater, but the festival continues at the PCC Cascade campus through March 5th. All screenings are free and open to the public. For more information about the Cascade Festival of African Films, go to africanfilmfestival.org. Experimental film screening series Cinema Project kicks off its spring 2016 season this week with the program Note to Self, Psychosexual Films of Nazlee Dancel. Filmmaker Dancel, who will be in attendance, works almost exclusively in 16mm film. Her short films deal with cultural dislocation and, through sometimes graphic imagery, she explores taboo subjects like the sexual awakening of girls. Dancel often uses the 16mm film stock as a metaphor for the body, directly manipulating the format surface with typewriters, hole punchers, and X-Acto knives. Note to Self, Psychosexual Films of Nazlee Dansel, screens at 7:30 p.m. on Monday, February 8th, with Cinema Project at Northwest 2nd and Davis in downtown Portland. For more information, cinemaproject.org. Ongoing through February 14th is the Juried Exchange Exhibition between Portland State University and the Pacific Northwest College of Art titled The Artist is Pleasant. The exhibition developed collaboratively by PNCA's Intermedia Department, PSU's Time Arts Collective, and performance artist Katie Piott. The Artist is Pleasant is a thematic survey of the intersections of art and humor. And in addition to sculpture, painting, and multimedia work, are two video art pieces. Chris Freeman's single-channel video called Looking for a Hookup, You? And a video installation from artist KCR Anderson called Boobies? The exhibition is free and open to the public, taking place at the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Center for Art and Design at 511 Northwest Broadway in room B10. The Artist is Pleasant closes February 14th. For more info, cal.pnca.edu. You've been listening to Other Cinema This Week. Until next time, I'm Lena Newman on X-Ray FM.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Big Spring is a town of about 30,000 people at the edge of oil country in West Texas. It's the place down-on-his-luck dishwasher Joe Buck flees at the beginning of the 1969 cult classic, Midnight Cowboy.
What are you going to do back east?
Hell, what do I got to stay around here for?
Back then, the town's economic engine was the Webb Air Force Base. But after the Vietnam War, the base shut down. Johnny Lou Avery Boyd was president of the local Chamber of Commerce at the time, and she says people thought the town was about to disappear.
That's what scared them to death. They said, you know, I own this little roofing company, and we're going to have all these vacant houses in town. There's not going to be anybody to repair these houses because there's nobody to sell them to. There's just that enormous pessimism that sets in when something really major bad is happening.
But Johnny Lou is no pessimist. She made calls and lobbied politicians to lure a new industry that took over the offices and dormitories in the heart of the old base. That industry was prisons. Two low-security federal prisons with one big difference. The first one was run by the government, and Johnny Lou describes it as the town's best friend. Inmates would come to church and decorate street lamps downtown at Christmas time, but the second federal prison?
I don't think it was the same feel at all. I don't think it ever has been. But it has not been something that is like a hated relative. It's more like, well, that's a distant relative.
That distant relative holds people convicted of federal crimes, but only ones who are not U.S. citizens. And it's run by a private company, not the U.S. government. It's one of 11 private prisons for non-citizens that the Federal Bureau of Prisons contracted starting in 2000 in the hopes of cutting costs. But recently, journalists and advocates have raised questions about how that cost cutting has affected the inmates after a series of riots.
This is new at 10. An FBI affidavit details what happened during an almost eight-hour deadly riot.
Housing units set on fire. Inmates violently shaking the fence.
The inmate told us they want the public to know the reason they're doing this is because an inmate was sick and they don't believe he was given the proper medical care.
Inmates actually did so much damage to one prison, it had to be shut down. And they did it in part over complaints of medical negligence. But it's been nearly impossible to figure out what kind of medical care inmates are getting until now. Seth Fried Wessler, a reporter for the Investigative Fund, won a lawsuit to get an extensive set of medical files from these prisons. Then he spent a year tracking down the stories they contained, from Mexico to Mississippi to Big Spring, Texas. That's where Reveal's Dan Alcorn joins him on the story.
If you want to know what's going on inside a prison, you can't just walk in the front door and look around. But in the case of Big Spring's private federal prison, you can get a pretty good look at the soccer field. From the road, through a couple barbed wire fences, you can see men in khaki and white streaming out of a squat tan building. Playing soccer, walking in pairs around the track. A short guy by the soccer goal is playing an accordion.
I've been looking into what happens in these prisons for years. This is the closest I've gotten to getting inside.
From here, Seth and I can see clues about what makes this prison different from the government-run prison next door. The inmates are mostly speaking Spanish. Again, they're all non-citizens. The sign out front says Geo Group Inc. That's the private company hired by the Federal Bureau of Prisons to run the place. But inside the prison, especially when it comes to medical care, the big difference is in the rules they have to follow.
Generally speaking, when prison experts talk about the Bureau of Prisons, they say that it's the best functioning prison system in the United States. But the kinds of rigorous policies that the Bureau of Prisons has developed to regulate staffing patterns and what kinds of workers do what in the provision of medical care, those rules aren't applied to the BOP's private prisons.
Seth wanted to find out how that affects patients, so he filed a public record request that got him over 9,000 pages of medical files and internal investigations, covering the entire 15-year history of these private prisons for non-citizens.
With handwritten notes from nurses and doctors, they're literally detailing minute by minute what's happening inside of medical clinics inside of these prisons.
Seth had doctors read all these files, and they found a pattern. Cases where lower standards and less qualified, less expensive workers came together to produce a medical disaster. Seth and I came to Big Spring to tell the story of one of those cases. But to understand what happened, it helps to start before things went wrong, when the guy in charge of healthcare was Dr. John Farquhar. Between 2010 and 2014, he was the one doctor for the more than 3,000 inmates.
Well, technically, I worked a 40-hour week, but you can't practice medicine on a 40-hour week. That's me.
Dr. Farquhar has rigid posture and a military haircut.
Hello.
And at 85 years old, he's still practicing medicine full-time, 7 days a week if he needs to.
I've always had a seven-day approach to medicine, and I didn't see anything unusual about that.
But he was unusual when compared to the other doctors in the prison medical files.
He was writing more notes than just about any other doctor in any of the other prisons. He was there all the time.
Whereas in other private prisons for non-citizens, medical notes were being written and medical decisions were being made by low-level medical workers, often licensed vocational nurses with only a year of training.
And then I started reading what he was writing.
Some of Dr. Farquhar's notes start normally by describing someone's symptoms or vital signs, but then they just go off, railing against his bosses, especially when they blocked him from transferring inmates out who were too sick to take care of in his limited prison clinic.
In one case, he wrote, "This man will almost certainly die," and that the Bureau of Prisons would, he wrote, "rush to find someone to blame, blithely ignoring the casual and repeated ways he has been dumped onto Big Spring."
There are times when I was critical. I'm a critical person, starting with myself.
You actually wrote at one point, "I feel bad for his shabby care."
Well, I stand by that statement. I don't know who it's about, and I can't comment on any single record of any person. But there are times when the care was not what I wanted for any patient, period.
He told us there was constant pressure to keep costs down. For instance, early on, his higher-ups told him to look at the number of times the prison had paid for an ambulance to take an inmate to the hospital.
They said, "You know, is there a way that we can cut this down?" And I said, "Probably yes."
I could imagine that could result in a pressure to not call when somebody really needs to go to the emergency room.
That's always the risk. That's why professional judgment takes professional training and professional experience, because you can't leave it up to anybody.
When Dr. Farquhar was clinical director, he was the one making those decisions. He was effectively always on call, and doctors who reviewed the medical files said he seemed to be doing as good a job as he could. But after 4 years, he said he was very tired, and he quit.
And then not long after he left the prison, there's a case that exhibits all of the problems that he was worried about.
The case of Nestor Garay. Back in 1998, when he was 25, Nestor came from Mexico City to wine country, Napa Valley, California.
It's beautiful here.
where he moved in with his parents, Alvara and Indy.
Hola, ¿cómo está?
Seth and I visited them at their house, just a couple blocks from the natural food stores and bike shops of Main Street, St. Helena. When Nestor first moved here, he was like peas in a pod with his younger brother, Enrique.
They say when we answer the phone, we sound the same and we smile kind of the same.
They worked out at the gym together, and they worked together at the Sunshine Food Market. Nestor was in the cheese section. Enrique cut meat. But while Enrique went on to get a better job, buy his own house, and become a U.S. citizen, Nestor just stayed in the same bedroom in his parents' house.
He was very strongly attached to my mom and dad. Yeah, to be with them is like a pet. He wanted to be with them the whole time. But in a good way, because Nestor was a good son and all that, regardless of his addiction.
His addiction. It started with alcohol, but turned to meth. He started dealing to support his habit, sold to an undercover cop, and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. And because he'd never become a U.S. citizen, at 41, he ended up in the private GEO Group prison for non-citizens in Big Spring. His parents have stacks of letters Nestor sent them from prison, each of them with a hand-drawn and colored cartoon on the envelope. There's a jack-o'-lantern for Halloween, an orange cat with a bow on its head opening a gift for Christmas. His dad, Indy, opens one.
Nada más para saludarlos y decirles que todo está bien aquí en Texas.
The letter starts, just to say hello and tell you all is well in Texas. And then, early one Thursday morning, Indy told us they got a phone call.
Me llamaron sus amigos de él, compañeros.
It was Nestor's cellmates, calling from inside the prison in Big Spring.
Una mala noticia.
With bad news.
Bueno, gracias por hablar conmigo.
Seth tracked down three of these cellmates, including Irineo Espinosa.
¿Con quién tengo el gusto? ¿Quién me habla?
Speaking by phone from Mexico, Irineo says it all started when he and the other men in the cell were asleep.
¿Alguna de la mañana?
At one in the morning, Nestor starts moaning.
Ay, 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 quejándose.
Irineo says Nestor is trying to speak, but he can only make signs with his hands. Irineo and the other cellmates carry him to a lower bunk and realize he's wet himself. They open the door and tell the guard outside that Nestor needs medical attention.
Llegó la enfermera como a la media hora.
Irineo says about a half hour later, a nurse arrives. It's licensed vocational nurse Gary Austin, the only medical professional at the prison that night. And it's his note that begins the medical file. It says, quote, upon arriving to inmate room, inmate lying on bottom bunk, looking straight ahead, but not responding to name. He writes that Nestor's sweaty. He has a weak grip on one side, and the cellmates think he's had a seizure. The cellmates are told to carry Nestor downstairs to the building's bare bones clinic. And there, instead of calling 911, Gary phones the physician assistant who's on call that night, Russell Amaru. Russell's at home asleep, but he wakes up and over the phone makes two key decisions. First, he tells the nurse to give Nestor Dilantin, an anti-seizure medication. And then, when Nestor can't swallow the pills, the notes show he gives a new order. Quote, send back to unit and place on mattress on floor. So the cellmates are asked to carry Nestor back upstairs. But Irineo says,
dijimos no.
The cellmates said no.
No. Él necesita atención médica profesional.
He says he needs professional medical attention. Ask for a helicopter, an ambulance, that can take him to a clinic so he can get the care he needs. Ultimately, Nestor isn't returned to their cell. So the cellmates go to sleep thinking Nestor was taken to a hospital.
Y al día siguiente nos damos cuenta que qué fue lo que pasó.
Irineo says the next day they find out what happened.
Que lo llevaron a otra celda.
Nestor was just brought to another cell nearby and was left on a mattress on the floor until the morning shift arrived. By now, 5 hours have passed since Nestor started moaning, and he's transformed. He can't move his right side. His attempts to speak have become smacking sounds. The morning shift nurse, a more highly trained registered nurse, calls the prison's clinical director, a doctor, and they send Nestor to the nearest ER, where a CAT scan shows a massive stroke. He's then helicoptered to the Midland Memorial Hospital. We wanted to find out what happened to him there, so Seth and I went to the hospital and tracked down the neurologist who treated him that day.
Hi, doctor.
Hey.
How are you?
How are you?
Good.
Dr. John Foster.
If someone comes in having just had a massive ischemic stroke, how soon would they need to come in here
for you to be able to do anything for them.
Well, to be anything aggressive to them within 3 hours.
So as each hour passes...
Each minute. You have thousands of brain cells dying.
And if someone does come in 5 hours later, what can you do at that point?
For us, there ain't nothing.
Nestor's parents say the prison finally called them that afternoon, but they didn't tell them that Nestor had had a stroke, much less the details they'd heard hours earlier from the cellmates. So the next day, as they were preparing to fly to Texas, Nestor's dad, Indy, called the prison to get more information.
What was the captain's name?
His granddaughter recorded some of the call.
Do you know how long you're going to be here?
I don't know, not sure. It depends. You know, how is Nestor?
I haven't heard nothing today.
In the hospital, Nestor was shackled to the bed, and two prison guards were keeping watch when his family arrived. His dad, Indy, his brother, Enrique, and his mom, Alvara.
Me controlé, no quise gritar, no quise
when we got there, I restrained myself. I didn't want to scream. I didn't want to yell because I really felt that my son could hear me. I didn't want him to hear me upset.
Yo recuerdo que lo abracé.
As soon as my mom started talking to Nestor, my mom hugged Nestor and Nestor cried. That's something I'm never going to forget. Somehow he was still there.
But the doctors told them that tear was just a reflex. Nestor was already gone. He was brain dead. His body was just being kept alive by the life support.
Fíjense qué crueldad.
I mean, look at the cruelty here. It wasn't until after they took him off life support that they took the shackles off.
Como que dijeron, si todavía vives.
It was as if they were saying, if you're still alive, then you're under my control.
The prison did its own internal review of what happened to Nestor Garay, and we got a copy. It found diagnosis was delayed, treatment was inappropriate, documentation was unacceptably incomplete. When Nestor didn't get better, the nurse or the physician assistant should have contacted the prison's doctor or top nurse. In other words, many things went wrong. But according to the four physicians we had independently review the medical file, the right thing to do was simple.
Call 911 is what he should have done.
That's neurologist Carolyn Martin.
If he had gotten there right away, he would have had a chance of survival. Not getting there right away, his chance of survival was really terrible. The prisoner was right, they should have called 911.
One reason they didn't call 911 could be the level of training of the only medical professional at the prison that night, Gary Austin. He's only a licensed vocational nurse, or LVN.
LVNs are essentially supervised, so they are not working independently.
Roberta Lavin is a nursing professor who used to work at a government-run federal prison. She says LVNs are usually supervised by a more highly trained registered nurse, while that higher-level nurse would know how to help someone with a gunshot wound, say. An LVN would help after they'd been stitched up, when it's time to give out the next dose of painkillers.
Or it's time to change that bandage.
She says to put LVNs alone on overnights at prisons, responding to emergencies, may save money, but it endangers inmates.
Having a person who has a more narrow scope of practice and is less prepared to deal with emergencies, what you're doing is you're putting barriers between that person who may have a medical emergency and the care.
You don't see this barrier to care in the government-run federal prisons. They have rules that specify what LVNs can do. But those rules don't apply to these private prisons. In a statement, GEO Group said they strive to meet all the same standards, practices, and policies of government-run federal prisons. But after interviewing corrections officials and reviewing thousands of pages of medical files, Seth found something different.
We see over and over again, low-level medical workers, often licensed vocational nurses, are providing the bulk of medical care. Doctors who reviewed the files raised questions about whether those licensed vocational nurses were operating beyond the kind of care that they're trained to provide.
Seth got the medical files of 103 men who all died in these private federal prisons for non-citizens. And doctors who reviewed those files and additional evidence said 25 of those men likely died as a result of inadequate medical care that they got in prison.
One of these cases, a man named Claudio Fajardo Saucedo, was seen repeatedly over and over again, complaining of headaches and back pain and nausea, and was only ever treated with ibuprofen and Tylenol and sent back to his bed. And he's nearly only seen by LVNs.
In fact, there's no record of him ever being sent to the prison doctor. After nearly 2 years of this, he's finally sent out to a hospital, where within days he dies of an AIDS-related brain infection. Doctors who reviewed the files said he should have been diagnosed with HIV long before. That case happened at another private prison for non-citizens, about 2 hours west of Big Spring, called Reeves. Last year, that prison was investigated by the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, a watchdog for the Bureau of Prisons. And we described Claudio's medical treatment and death to the Inspector General himself, Michael Horowitz.
It certainly doesn't surprise me what you're saying.
His review didn't look at the use of LVNs, but it did look at the number of total medical staff. And it found that in 34 out of 37 months, the prison had failed to meet the minimum required by its contract.
I think it raises two concerns. How does it impact individual inmates, and what does it mean for their health and safety? And the second is, why was it happening for 34 out of 37 months? Why wasn't that caught before we showed up?
He's asking not just why this company was breaking the rules, but why the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which is supposed to enforce the rules, failed to notice any problems for 3 years straight. Since Nestor's death, his parents have kept his bedroom in their Napa Valley home the way he left it.
Bueno, en este cuarto les voy a ser honesta.
I'll be honest with you. We sleep in this room.
They sleep surrounded by Nestor's things.
Esta es su ropa de mi hijo.
His mom, Alvara, shows us Nestor's pants in the dresser, his hat on the door.
Me da tristeza por esto.
She picks up a pair of his gym shorts from the closet, pero, and smells them before she puts them back.
Ay. His clothes, I think we should get rid of it, give it to someone who needs it. But you want to keep him too?
That's Nestor's older brother, Carlos. And he wants to help his family move on. But he also wants to know why his brother wasn't taken to the hospital sooner.
I can make a list of people that were involved, but who's really responsible? Who's the boss? So I want an answer from the person who contracts these companies, and I want an answer from the warden.
The Federal Bureau of Prisons, which contracted GEO Group to run the prison, wouldn't agree to an interview and didn't respond to written questions. The GEO Group and its medical subcontractor, Correct Care Solutions, said because of privacy concerns, they were unable to comment on individual medical files. Gary Austin, the licensed vocational nurse who was at the prison that night, didn't return our messages. But Russell Amaru, the physician assistant who the medical file says gave the order over the phone to send Nestor back to his cell instead of a hospital...
Hi.
You Mr. Amaru?
I could be, and who are you?
Seth and I visited his house in a condo complex 40 minutes outside Big Spring, Texas.
Let me ask you guys a question. How'd you find out about me?
At first, he refused to speak with us.
You're not supposed to talk. That's one of the problems with the prison system.
But eventually, he led us into his kitchen and spoke for several hours because he wanted the world to know about all the other factors that he said prevented the medical staff at Big Spring from doing their jobs as well as they should.
There would have been a more aggressive care for that patient and other patients too if we had better training, better staff. It's just so many things are wrong there.
He explains the decisions he made the night Nestor died, decisions doctors and the prison's own review said were wrong, by pointing to a failure of communication. He says all the information he had was what he was told over the phone by Gary Austin, the licensed vocational nurse at the prison. Gary wrote in the file that Nestor was unresponsive and had a weak grip. But Russell says he was told something different.
He was up and communicating. It just, he was not real lucid.
And he pins that miscommunication on Gary's lack of training, the fact that he was an LVN, also called an LPN.
You had an LPN... right out of school, new in corrections, trying to make an assessment. He did not have the skills. I don't blame them as the person. I blame the management system that puts him in that position.
It's easy to blame the person. And the four physicians who reviewed Nestor's file and the prison's own review did find fault with both Gary, the LVN, and Russell, the physician assistant. But if you blame only the person, you let the system that put them in that position off the hook. And the system that Russell describes is one that puts its staff and its inmates in a position that's always just one mistake away from a catastrophe.
Basically, what you have in essence is people that are undertrained doing jobs that they shouldn't be doing. We do not have an infirmary for 24-hour observation. Charts are often temporarily lost for a couple of days or a week or so. And so the companies that I work for, all the way up to BOP, they've got the model of how the place is supposed to be run, and they seem to allow it. And I know you want to ask me, what would I do to correct the problem? I'd close this whole facility down, and I'd start over again.
The Department of Justice's Inspector General is currently reviewing all the contracts for private federal prison for non-citizens, but it can only make suggestions to the decision makers at the Bureau of Prisons. Those decision makers can pull the plug on the Big Spring and Reeves prisons because both of those contracts are up for renewal in 2017. The decision about whether or not to extend them is expected later this year. You can read the investigative fund reporter Seth Fried Wessler's full investigation in The Nation magazine. But after the break, we'll turn to the question of where these prisons came from in the first place. It's a story of a major shift in criminal justice policy, and also a story of a father risking everything for his sons. That's coming up next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. We're going to continue our investigation with Seth Fried Wessler of the Investigative Fund into the little-known system of private prisons that hold non-citizens convicted of federal crimes. Now we're going to turn to the crimes that put them there, because this might be the most surprising thing about these prisons. The latest stats show 40% of the more than 20,000 inmates are not there for robbery, fraud, or even drugs. They're serving time for the federal crime of illegally crossing the border. Now, most people caught crossing the border are not sent to prison. They're just deported. But criminal prosecution has been climbing through the Bush and Obama administrations. It's a part of a policy called enforcement with consequences. We're going to show you the change and the consequences by following one man who's lived it, Eloy Flores. Seth tracked him down, and he talked with him and Reveal's Stan Alcorn.
How many times do you think you've crossed total?
Maybe like 20 times or more.
So it's like almost once a year.
Yeah, pretty much once a year, two times a year.
To be clear, all these times he was crossing illegally. He never had an employer or a family member who could sponsor him for a green card. And so he says he never really tried.
To get a visa in Mexico, you got to be a rich man. Or get bank accounts and own houses and good jobs.
When Eloy first crossed, he said he never even had a job. He was a teenager looking to escape from the slow, violent divorce of his parents. And so, New Year's Eve, 1990, he and six other guys wade across the Rio Grande, naked.
Naked, yes. You got to get naked, and you got to get your clothes on top of your head. That way they don't get wet.
They get to the other side, Brownsville, Texas, dry off, put their clothes back on, and walk to a Kmart parking lot. There, they squeeze into the beat-up Mustang of Eloy's best friend. But then the car won't start.
So we got to get off the car and we got to push it, the car. And behind us, across a border patrol, and didn't even pay attention to us. He just crossed by.
I mean, they could clearly see you?
We are in the road. But wait till I tell you another times I've crossed the border. This is nothing. From 1990 to 2005, I think it was the easy ones. From 2006 to today is really hard to cross the border, yeah.
The story of how it got hard is also the story of how those private prisons got filled. And it's also Eloy's story. It starts in that beat-up Mustang, where reveals Stan Alcorn picks it up.
After they got the car started, Eloy and his best friend drove all the way from Brownsville, Texas, to Silver Spring, Maryland. That's where Eloy got his first job, standing outside a 7-Eleven at dawn, waiting for contractors to pull up in their trucks looking for workers.
We are like 150 guys waiting for one truck or two trucks. You are lucky if you get a jump on the truck. Because if you ask him for painter, everybody was a painter. If you ask him for a carpenter, we are a carpenter, 150 guys right there. So as soon as the truck show up, man, you got to be ready and you got to jump on the truck.
This is how he spent his first few years in Maryland, jumping into truck beds, digging holes, painting houses.
I had no holidays, no Christmas, nothing. No stop, working every day. I was workaholic because I want to get better.
And his life did get better and better. He started his own painting company. He got married and had kids. He even bought a house in Baltimore County with woods in the backyard. And whenever he wanted to take a break, he'd just go to Mexico and then sneak back to the U.S.
Yeah, it was really easy. You can cross the border easy.
It was so easy, he did it once a year through the 90s. And then in 2008, he and his whole family went back for a few years. He wanted his four kids, who grew up in Maryland and are U.S. citizens, to experience their parents' country and learn their parents' language. Their stay in Mexico was supposed to end in 2011.
It was time to go back because all my children, they speak Spanish 100%. My older son is need to be go to the university. So it was time to go back.
Eloy and his wife planned to hire a human smuggler to help them cross the border, and then the kids would follow legally on a plane.
It was part of my plan, but I didn't make it because I find to cross the border is really, really hard.
In the two decades since he waded across the river to Brownsville, things had changed. The number of Border Patrol agents had increased fivefold, pushing the places to cross way out into the desert. Seth and I walked a tiny part of one of those routes in West Texas. It's a flat plain of sand and creosote bushes.
Was he by himself?
No.
This is roughly where Eloy and his wife were caught, tracked down by footprints in the sand, they think. And then...
Security?
This is the Border Patrol station in Del Rio, Texas, where we walked through the process with spokesperson Enrique Vasquez.
And you're in our processing area.
Half the room is made up of holding cells, and the other half looks like a grim metallic version of airport passport control.
It's similar. They come up here, you interview them, you get their name, you get their basic information.
And then the agent sends almost every crosser to be criminally prosecuted for illegal entry. It's a program called Operation Streamline. It started here in Del Rio in 2005, but was soon adopted elsewhere on the border. To explain why it exists,
I'll let you step in on this.
He turns to Agent Joshua Spriggs from the Border Patrol's prosecution office, who says the idea is to create more of a deterrent than a simple deportation.
The desired outcome is that will affect them wanting to come back again illegally, meaning they know now if I go, they're just going to send me right back. Did it have the desired effect? Well, he's back again. So it didn't. So we need to try and find something else that maybe influences his decision to try and come back legally next time instead of crossing between the ports of entry.
And do you track that?
I'm sure we track everything. I mean, we have numbers for it. I don't have a number for you, but to say that it's effective, I would say yes.
The Border Patrol used to point to statistics showing that border crossers who were prosecuted were less likely to cross again. But they're now scrapping that measure because an agency watchdog pointed out they weren't checking if the effect lasted more than a year. Still, this policy of using the threat of prison time as a kind of psychological border wall, this is why Eloy and his wife were sent to federal court. This is a recording we got of the hour and a half in court for Aloy, his wife, and 82 other people charged with illegal entry. The voices you hear are from attorneys, a Spanish-English interpreter, and Magistrate Judge Victor Garcia. The defendants, who fill the jury box and even the benches for the public, are silent, except for the jingle of their chains.
And all of you, please stand up so I can give you the
oath. All the immigrants, we're looking around. Everybody's locked up from the ankles, knees, waist, and each other.
They're all wearing identical jumpsuits and what look like paper surgical masks over their mouths. Aloy says they could only see each other's eyes.
That's why we are like a numbers now. We're not person, we are numbers.
You are guaranteed a set of rights. You will be asked to waive them so that I can take your plea. These are your rights. Listen closely.
This is how the Streamline program works. In order to prosecute nearly every first-time crosser, nobody gets a separate proceeding. They're all processed as a group.
Yes or no, do you want to plead guilty today?
Courts have decided it would violate due process to have them answer questions in unison. So instead, the judge points to them one at a time.
Yes or no?
Which takes a little more than a minute per question.
Yes by all.
Okay.
The one place where each individual gets attention is for sentencing, because the sentences depend on the defendant's criminal history, which usually means have they tried to cross the border before.
Mr. Calderona, you're going to be the first one of many that I have today that you have a conviction for illegal entry.
The more times someone's been caught and convicted for crossing in the past, the more jail time he gets this time.
You got 8 days the first time, you're getting 4 months the second time, it's up to 2 years the third time.
That's time he'll spend in a U.S. prison before being deported back to his home country. After a few cases, these sentences start to blend together.
Guilty or not guilty?
But for Aloy,
Mr. Fitz,
Judge Garcia decides to give a little speech.
You're not being prosecuted for being a bad person or because you do not have good reasons. Most of the people here, if not all of them, have very good reasons to cross, to work, to support their families, to better educate their kids, sometimes to pay off debts. The problem that you have, like all others, is you do not have permission to enter. But because you have a prior conviction, to be consistent and fair, the sentence I give you is because you have a prior conviction, not because you've done something wrong to the United States yet. You don't have permission to enter. So you got to do 4 months in prison. The only reason it's 4 months is because maybe after you do that long in prison, you will not return. I don't know that. I cannot stop you from coming back. But I can tell you what will happen if you do, and that you're going to be in prison. I know 4 months is a long time, considering you need to get back to your children. Your wife is here as well. But it's a lesson for everybody else that you cannot cross. Those days are over. You understand?
Yes.
Is there anything else you want to tell me?
No.
Thank you. Jesús García Franco.
Criminal prosecutions of border crossing have been on the rise since the 90s, when the Border Patrol started something called Prevention Through Deterrence. John Clausen became the head federal prosecutor in Midland, Texas, in the middle of all this, in 2003.
Illegal immigration was, I don't know if it was skyrocketing, but it was certainly on the upswing. And so there was a lot of discussion, well, how can we stop it or reduce it significantly? What are some things that we might try?
The Border Patrol got more funding and more agents. Operation Streamline started, prosecuting more first-time border crossers for illegal entry. And John says he was told by his superiors to prosecute as many people as he could for illegal re-entry, a felony charge for crossing after being deported. He says it was all kind of an experiment in discouraging not only the people sent to prison, but everyone they knew.
The idea is the word would spread, that they would go back to their home areas in Mexico and they would tell everybody else, man, it's not worth it. Because if you cross, you're going to end up spending, you know, a few months in jail and it stinks and therefore don't come.
More than 70,000 people were prosecuted in 2015 for immigration offenses. That's nearly twice as many as a decade ago. In fact, more people are now prosecuted for illegally crossing the border than all other categories of federal crime, drugs, weapons, white-collar crime, combined. But it's still only a fraction of the more than 300,000 people apprehended by Border Patrol each year.
And in general, why not prosecute everyone?
Because you can't possibly. I mean, if we were to prosecute every minute immigration offense, it would take up all of federal prosecutors' time, and we would not be able to devote our attention to other very serious criminal behavior which we're charged with addressing.
Seth and I visited Atlacomulco, a small town north of Mexico City. It was supposed to be Eloy and his family's temporary home, but they've now been here for 8 years. Their main source of income is an internet cafe sandwiched between a tortilla factory and an office supply store.
Yeah, this is my small shop. I designed myself and I built everything you can see.
Eloy built little wooden cubicles with saloon doors for the computers. But when we visited, none of them were occupied. Eloy's oldest son, Eduardo, was manning the front desk.
Basically, we just take turns. Right now is my turn.
When he's not working, Eduardo's studying engineering at a local Mexican college. As a U.S. citizen, he could go to college in the States, but it would be a huge expense. And his parents are just scraping by as it is.
Right now, they're both here and we're happy, but happiness isn't helping us pay for food, paying for our school, our tuitions, because university's hard. Even here, it's hard, and I'm going to a public university.
All right, now let's go.
In 2 years, when Eduardo turns 21, he can sponsor his parents to get in line for a green card so they could get into the U.S. legally. But because of their history of illegally crossing and living in the U.S., they'd likely be barred from the country for 6 more years. And so even though Eloy spent 4 months in the private prison in Big Spring, Texas, he's talking about crossing again.
It's not for me anymore. Now it's for my sons. They are U.S. citizens. My older son, he always dreamed about study over there. So that's why I feel guilty, because I fell in, not crossing the border.
Does the threat of being locked up in prison, does that make you think twice?
I make you think twice, but not stop it. Being locked up is only be slowed down. Sooner or later, we'll be there. I see a lot of friends, they're being locked up, spend 6 or 4 months, they're already in USA. So America is spending a lot of money. To give you a lesson, they don't work.
He told us there was a 50-50 chance he'd try to cross this year. And if he does, he figured there was a 90% chance he'd get caught, but a 10% chance he'd make it. It's like a lottery ticket, he said. If you win, you win. If you don't, you don't.
We don't have numbers for how many people have decided not to cross the border because they think the odds of prison are too high. We do know how many people crossed anyway and got caught. And that number is down 70% in the last decade. But the biggest factor analysts cite for that drop, it's not prison. It's the financial crisis. When there are no jobs, the United States is a lot less appealing. Thanks to Seth Fried Wessler of the Investigative Fund for collaborating with us on that story. After the break, we turn to how building up border security has created problems for the Border Patrol itself. That's coming up on Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Before the break, we heard how illegally crossing the border has become the most prosecuted federal crime. A big part of that is the fact that over the past 10 years, the number of agents patrolling the U.S.-Mexico border has nearly doubled to more than 20,000. That increase has come with problems for the Border Patrol. Last June, an internal investigation found corruption, abuse of power, and questionable use of force, specifically some high-profile shootings. Several high-ranking officers have raised scathing criticism of Customs and Border Protection. Reveal's Andrew Becker covers what's happening on the border, and he joins me now. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Al.
So, you've been looking into these cases of killings at the border. Now, we've got tape of one high-profile, controversial incident of a Border Patrol officer in Nogales, Arizona, firing across the border and killing a boy in Nogales, Mexico. The shooting back in 2012 led to an investigation by the Border Patrol and the FBI. Why don't you tell us about that?
What happened was, it's about 11 o'clock at night, 11:15 at night, and there's a call that comes in to the Nogales Police Department saying that somebody sees some suspicious activity.
530 West International Street, 530 West International, reference to suspicious person.
There's two guys who have tried to smuggle marijuana into the United States, and there's a border fence that splits the United States from Mexico here.
I got bundles.
The excited voice you hear is Nogales Police Department saying, we've got bundles, which are basically their blocks of marijuana that the smugglers have been trying to get into the United States. What happens is the police show up and they're watching these smugglers try to climb over this 18-foot tall fence. And they're pretty casual about it, hands on hips, just watching them try to cross back over. When a Border Patrol agent shows up, the next pizza tape you hear is shots fired. That's a Nogales police officer who's reporting that the Border Patrol agent, who had just arrived, walked up to the fence, put his arm between the two metal bars of the fence, and started firing into Mexico.
Chukis are throwing. They're throwing rocks.
And finally,
possibly the shots are coming from them. And maybe one dead on in the Mexican side.
That tape is saying there's one down on the Mexican side. And it turns out that was a teenager who was killed. It was a 16-year-old named Jose Elena Rodriguez. And he had been walking on the street below the fence on the Mexican side of the border when he was shot. And his family has said he was just walking along the street after having played basketball and got caught in the crossfire. The Border Patrol, however, says that he was in the area and possibly in the group that was throwing rocks.
So this incident is sort of a boiling point of all the shootings and other incidents that involved Customs and Border Protection, and it's raised some serious concerns. You spoke with the former head of Internal Affairs, James Tomczyk. What did he have to say?
So Tomczyk was the head of internal affairs from 2006 until 2014. And his role and responsibility was really to try to clean up internally the Border Patrol, to screen out suspect applicants, to weed out bad hires, and to address some of the misconduct within the agency. And this is one of the shooting incidents that Tomczyk was most concerned about. I mean, this is an incident that he describes as something that basically keeps him up at night. Part of the issue for Tomczyk, who says that he has seen this actual surveillance footage that has not been made public, is the fact that the version of events that the Border Patrol reported doesn't really follow what he has seen in this video.
The video that we saw clearly revealed that the Border Patrol agent exited his vehicle, walked to the fence, fired all rounds in his weapon, which would be one round in the chamber and 12 rounds in the magazine, and then reloaded and fired at least once again. Mexican authorities reported that the victim in this case was struck in the head 3 times and 5 times in the back.
And Andy, Tomczyk also told you that he was constantly butting heads with leaders in Customs and Border Protection, as well as other agencies, as he was trying to investigate these incidents.
They frequently attempted to put forth information in the initial briefings that was false and in some cases completely fabricated in an effort to give the initial impression that it was a legitimate use of force. There was a focus on 28 incidents of fatal use of force. 7 of them appeared to be highly suspect in terms of whether or not the use of force was appropriate.
So Tomczyk was forced out. What are other officials at the Border Patrol saying? Do they agree with him, or is he kind of an outlier?
Tomchuk's not really alone on this one. We talked to his former deputy. We talked to former high-ranking officials in Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the FBI, and they are seeing many of the same things, really in response to the massive growth in the Border Patrol. And with that growth, it has certainly led to some growing pains. And for the first time under the Obama administration, there is a commissioner who was actually confirmed by the U.S. Senate. His name is Gil Kerlikowske. He's something of a reformer, and he has acknowledged that there are some issues with the Border Patrol.
There were questionable shootings. 15 cases went back to our Internal Affairs Unit for additional review. We need the trust and frankly, the credibility of a law enforcement agency if we're going to get people to cooperate and help us.
So you've spoken to agents themselves. I mean, what are they saying about all this?
The rank-and-file Border Patrol agent is represented by a very powerful Border Patrol union. And what they basically say is that the territory is ruled by ruthless drug traffickers and cartels, and they've really had to react in a much more forceful way in order to protect the border. And so one of the people that we spoke with is Arturo Cueto. He's a Border Patrol agent. He says that in the time frame that we're talking about here, the Border Patrol has made something like 6 million arrests, and they've had less than 50 fatalities. So in his mind, he thinks that they're doing a pretty good job showing restraint.
I mean, I know it's hard right now, especially in the United States, with this whole anti-law enforcement feeling. And we don't want to work with criminals. We don't want to work with dirtbags. We go out there and we actually believe in a cause. We believe in the oath that we took. And we're not the bad guys in the story.
Sort of looking at the big picture here, while all of this is going on at the border, we are having high-profile police shootings all across the country. So why aren't these incidents along the border getting the same attention?
The border is often treated as kind of a third country or a forgotten space. It's rural, it's remote, there isn't a lot of or a very large political voice. And it's something in particular that James Tomchuk, the former head of Internal Affairs, brought up when he was talking to us. Here's what he said.
In the months since my removal, a series of tragic events have unfolded in Ferguson, Staten Island, which appeared to appropriately cause a very timely and appropriate response from the Department of Justice. A question that I've asked myself is that certainly all lives matter, but in these many instances we've discussed and the many that we haven't, don't brown lives matter?
It's not every day you hear someone who is at Tomchuk's level who says something like, brown lives matter. Do you think anything is going to change inside the Border Patrol?
In some ways, it's actually already changing. A number of the reforms that Tomchuk had been pushing for when he was still the Internal Affairs Chief are actually being implemented under the new Commissioner, Gil Kerlikowske. That's augmented use of force training for Border Patrol agents. It's actually giving the Internal Affairs Office the authority to investigate crimes and serious misconduct, which they didn't have before. And a recommendation from a government advisory council to actually double the number of internal affairs agents to look into such crime and potential misconduct.
That's Reveal's Andrew Becker. Thanks to Ike Srikandaraja for producing that piece. And thanks to our partners, MSNBC and Telemundo. And that's it for this week's show. Huge thank you to the Investigative Fund and reporter Seth Fried Wessler for partnering with us this week. If you want to read Seth's story for The Nation, go to revealnews.org. Stan Alcorn was our lead producer. Thanks to editor Esther Kaplan of the Investigative Fund. Our lead sound designer and engineer is my man, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs. We had additional engineering help from Claire C. Money Mullen and Joe Plord. Our theme music is by Camarado Lightning. Amy Powell's our managing editor. Our head of studio is Krista Scharfenberg. Suzanne Reber is our executive editor, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.
Thank you. Support for X-Ray FM comes from Bridge City Cleaning Service, a local company providing custom cleaning to hundreds of homes in the greater Portland area. More information at bridgecitycleaning.com or by phone at 503-238-1232.
Support for X-Ray FM comes from Animal Traffic and The Annex, who believe in American workers and local craftspeople, providing men's and women's clothing, backpacks, and accessories at both Animal Traffic locations.